Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome, everybody, to the Ad Nauseam Podcast. My name is Jeff Winkle. I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Dave Noe. How you doing, Dave?
I'm doing great, Jeff.
Staying warm today?
I am.
It's a rainy day here.
Weather has changed here outside the vomitorium. We had some light snow on the ground yesterday.
Yesterday, yeah.
A little pre-Thanksgiving snow.
But now it's got that kind of that November gloom.
Absolutely.
Yes. As always, it's nice and balmy.
Absolutely.
Here in the vomitorium.
I would say balmy. We're wearing our Hawaiian shirts, our Crocs.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Looking good, feeling good. Can you believe it? It's episode 13 today.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yes. We'll be talking some Cicero. We'll be talking about gorging on books.
We're going for the big guy, right?
The
Cicero?
Big guy. Oh, man. Yes. We're not pulling any punches.
No.
Yeah, we're ready. But before we get into that, we have a shout out, as we always do. And this week's shout out goes to Dr. Samuel Husky.
I believe it's Samuel J. Husky.
Samuel J. Husky, pardon me, who is in the Department of Classics in the University of Oklahoma, I believe. And but you know Sam.
Yeah, Sam and I were classmates in graduate school.
Oh, okay, yeah.
A little known fact about Sam, he's actually quite a good bass player.
No way.
Yeah, good bass player and doesn't care for Mozart, if I remember correctly.
Is that right? Right?
He says it's all up and down the scale. He's a Bach man through and through.
Yep. Is he a rock guy?
I mean, I don't really know. Okay. Sam and I have kind of gone our separate ways in the last 45 years.
But he's listened to the podcast.
He loves it.
Yeah, that's great. Well, so a shout out to Sam, and thanks for listening as always.
So Jeff,
yes.
I think you're going to get us started this week. We have a little bit of a gustatory opener this time.
Yes.
An appetizer, you might say.
Yes, exactly.
This one's from Herodotus. So
Herodotus,
let's hear it.
Fairly early on in his histories. And this is a passage in where he's talking about how the Greeks celebrate their birthdays. And he writes, "Their courses are few, the dainties that follow many. And not all serve together. This is why the Persians say of Greeks that they rise from the table still hungry, because not much dessert is set before them. Were this too given to Greeks, the Persians say, they would never stop eating. They are very partial to wine. No one may vomit or urinate in another's presence. This is prohibited among them."
That's crazy.
It's more information than I think I needed.
Absolutely. Whose translation is that, by the way?
That is the A.D. Godley's translation, Harvard University Press from 1920.
Okay, so that one's in the public domain.
It is in the public domain.
All right.
Exactly right. I love that detail about if they had dessert, they would never stop eating.
Yeah, you mean the Persians, right? Is that what it's saying?
I think the Persians are saying that about the Greeks.
If they got some dessert.
They wouldn't stop.
That was like you at Thanksgiving, right?
Absolutely.
Now, we're having a little bit of a time warp issue here, aren't we?
Well, what do you mean?
We're recording this pre-Thanksgiving,
but
people are listening post-Thanksgiving.
This will drop after Thanksgiving.
Correct. And that's going to play into today's episode, isn't it?
That's right. Exactly right. So,
Speaking of which,
you want to talk a little bit about what we're talking about?
Well, okay. So the Thursday, November 26 came and went, which in America, and, you know, of course, we don't have only American or North American listeners.
We're
thankful for the listeners around the world. But on November 26, that Thursday, a lot of people eat.
A lot of people
they
eat
turkey, cranberries. You like cranberries, Jeff?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stuffing,
mashed potatoes.
All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So once they have eaten probably too much of this extensive fare, their minds turn away from their stomachs to...
Football.
Football. How did you describe football to me once? Big guy standing on the sideline, punctuated with occasional activity.
That's right. Yeah.
You had a pretty dim view, a low view of football.
I did. I don't want to bring down the hate on me.
Okay.
Though,
all right.
It's true. It is true.
We'll leave that aside.
So, but if their minds aren't turning toward football,
they ought to turn toward literature.
Exactly.
Epicureans, right? What did they say?
The delight of hanging out with friends.
Yes.
And talking about books.
Right. Yeah. Friendship is the keenest pleasure.
That's right.
The second pleasure is literature.
Literature, right.
So we're going to talk today about this interesting Latin verb, helluari.
Right.
Which means to gorge.
In all my years of study and reading Latin, I had never come across this verb before.
Hmm. I found it because it's at the beginning of book 3 of Cicero's philosophical work, De Finibus Bonorum et Malorum, the limits of good and evil.
Yes.
So at the beginning of book 3, Cicero drops this amazing word in here, helluari. And he uses it to talk about his friend, at least in the literary setting, he calls him a friend, Cato. This is Cato the Younger.
Okay, yes, Cato the Younger, the guy who hated Caesar.
That's right.
Right.
He later got the name Cato Uticensis, Cato from Utica.
Which is where he committed suicide.
Yeah, I think it's, what, northwest of New York City, somewhere like
exactly.
that?
Exactly, I know what he was doing over there.
Yeah,
how
so
he got there.
North Africa during the war, right, the Civil War, Cato was leading the Republican forces against Julius Caesar and so forth.
Yes.
And so in Utica, he decides to commit suicide.
Right. It's a gory scene.
It is. It's a botched job.
A botched job.
A Stoic commits suicide by plunging a knife into his entrails.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah.
But somehow Cato doesn't do it properly, so it takes him several days to bleed out.
It's absolutely brutal.
Yeah.
Right.
Very painful. But he got the nickname thereby, Cato the Younger, Cato Uticensis.
Yes. So we're going to talk about him in happier days.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of interesting things to say about him. But as the setup for this particular episode, we have the beginning of De Finibus Book 3.
Okay. So Dave, why don't you read a little bit for us from the Latin?
Oh, I'd love to. So it starts out like this. Namen Tusculano cum essem velemque e bibliotheca pueri loculi quibustam libris uti veni in eos villam ut eos ipse ut solebam de promorem, etc. Well, we got to get to this good part here. Quocum venissem Marcum Catonem.
Marcum Catonem.
That's right. Marcus Cato.
Yes.
So, Jeff, can you read a little bit of the translation of that portion in case our listeners weren't able to translate on the fly?
On the fly,
in
they
real
probably
time?
Could, but just in case.
All right.
Go something like this. I, Cicero, was down at my place at Tusculum and wanted to consult some books from the library of the young Lucullus. So I went to his country house, as I was in the habit of doing, to help myself to the volumes I needed. On my arrival, seated in the library, I found Marcus Cato.
Hmm.
Yes.
That's great.
Yep.
So this is the Rackham translation.
Okay.
The Rackham Sackham translation.
I think that's the later edition.
Is that later?
Yeah,
okay.
This is
the Loeb Classical Library.
Okay.
1914. Right. So he stumbled upon Marcus Cato, went to borrow some books, Cicero did, stumbled upon Marcus Cato. Who hasn't had this experience?
Of finding Cato in the library?
Yeah, you go off to, you know, the Grand Rapids Public Library or here at Calvin, where I teach, the Heckman Library, and there's Marcus Cato seated among the stacks, right?
Yeah.
And what's he doing there?
He's surrounded by books.
Surrounded by books.
That's right. So you want to get to the library before Cato gets there.
Right.
Otherwise, you're not going to find anything you want.
It's hopeless.
That's right. Do you want to do a little bit more Latin and we can get to the translation?
Yeah, absolutely, because there's this really wonderful part here.
Yeah.
Vidi in bibliotheca sedentem multis circum fusum stoicordrum libris.
Circum fusum.
Circum fusum.
Just completely surrounded. Just
completely poured all around.
Poured all around, right.
Overwhelmed, lying under a stack of books, something like that. Circum fusum libris.
Yes.
Erat enim ut scis in eo aviditas legendi nec satiare poturat.
Yes.
Maybe, Jeff, you can read all of that little bit there that I just read.
Sure. So he finds Marcus Cato in the library. And Cicero says, I had not known he was there. He was surrounded by piles of books on Stoicism, for he possessed, as you are aware, a voracious appetite for reading and could never have enough of it.
Hmm. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that very much. So this was written in 45 after Cicero had left politics because now Julius Caesar is ascendant.
Yes.
Right. And so heroes like Cato and Cicero, they don't really have a lot to do.
Oh, yeah, good point.
So they go into a literary kind of retirement. Now, they'll both emerge later and have a lot of trouble with that,
right.
Of course.
I mean, this is 45, so for both of these guys, their days are numbered.
Absolutely.
Not much longer.
There's no doubt. So then Cicero, he writes this extended dialogue where he's talking about, this is De Finibus, he's talking about Epicurean philosophy, Stoic philosophy. At the beginning of Book 3, he's going to give us a full-on description of Stoicism.
Hmm.
And he makes Marcus Cato the representative of that.
Right.
Now that's a topic for maybe several later episodes.
Sure.
Something that's dear to my heart, Stoicism. But the point we're really focusing on is the kind of man Cato was. He was aviditas legendi, absolutely bent on reading.
Yes.
And he could not be satisfied with it. Nec satiare poturat.
That's right. There's all of these eating words involved, right?
Yeah.
People describe this as being voracious readers, right?
So the fact that we have the same kinds of terms that describe two different kinds of hunger.
Yeah.
The physical hunger that you can satisfy with green bean casserole.
Right.
Maybe with a slice of apple pie. And then the intellectual hunger, which is satisfied by what?
By reading.
By books,
by books, exactly right. Yeah.
By conversation also?
If that's all part of that kind of Epicurean ideal, right?
Okay.
Right. I think it's interesting that when we hear, well, at least when I hear the word Epicurean in a modern sense, it almost always means food.
Yes.
But as you were saying earlier, that's below friendship and below literature.
Right.
Right. So
food comes quite a ways down on the chain of Epicurean delights.
Exactly right, yeah. I would say that, you know, one of the differences is that intellectual hunger in some ways is designed to never be satiated.
Right.
Right? It's always that thirst for more.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Although sometimes one does feel a little full, you might say. You eat a big meal, you go lie down, take a nap.
Yeah.
Maybe that's kind of my typical practice. That's what I'll be doing this Thursday.
Yeah.
You read a good book, you read something that's really intellectually stimulating. I find I often have to go do something that isn't intellectually stimulating. Something
that's
totally and completely mindless.
Yeah.
This is why I watch movies or television.
Yeah.
Because I don't really like to think about it too much.
I hear you. Yeah.
It's escapism.
Exactly. I often find that when I finish a good, satisfying book, there's also kind of a little bit of kind of a, like a postpartum. There's kind of a depression.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You know,
it's over. Can't I go back?
Right. And so you want to distract yourself with something maybe mindless to kind of get away from those feelings.
Yes, another idea I've been exploring recently is the connection between physical exercise and thinking. There's been a movement, I don't really know to whom to credit it, but there's been a movement to talk about great thinkers who have done a lot of walking.
Yeah.
Right? They have walked as they thought.
I think that's so true.
Yes.
I find that too. And it doesn't have to be necessarily an intellectual problem.
No.
Just the other day, I was working on a song that I'm writing, and I was sitting there in front of the piano and just completely stuck. I went for a walk. And in 30 minutes, I had finished it.
Right.
And
had finished the walk or the song?
Well, the walk and the song.
At the same time.
At the same time, right. There's something about that physical movement and kind of the rhythm of walking.
I wonder if it's possible also that maybe this is just saying more about my stomach appetites, but as you walk, you're building up a kind of physical hunger, and maybe that releases your mind to think.
Yeah.
Speculative, but.
I like that. Yeah.
Well, let's get back to Cicero.
Let's do it.
So, Jeff, just to summarize quickly what Cicero gives us here, Cato had this avidetas legendi, this intense desire for reading.
Mm-hmm.
He had this inability to be satiated.
Right.
He's piled up with books, circum fusum libris. And then the really key word here, helluari libris. He's gorging on books.
Gorging on books.
He's a glutton for books.
That's right. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that word?
Yeah, I looked it up because, like you were saying earlier, it's an unusual word.
We're not exactly sure where it comes from.
In fact,
right?
Nobody is,
right.
As it turns out. I did a little bit of homework. I looked in the Brill edition of the Etymological Dictionary of Latin and the Other Italic Languages by a guy named Michel Devon. This is Brill 2008. And actually, it was quite disappointing.
Hmm.
Nobody knows where this word, helluari, comes from. It occurs in the poet Terence. Where it's translated as to squander or to be a glutton.
Okay.
It could be from the Umbrian language. That's one suggestion, but Devon does not find that persuasive. No,
okay.
He thinks that's really a dead end. It can mean someone who engages in luxury or who's a spendthrift.
Okay.
So really the only thing we know about it is that it means to take in too much of something, to just go hog wild.
Yeah.
On whatever is your interest.
And I wonder if Cicero is playing there, but you know, Cato was famous for his simple dress, right? And,
oh, yes.
You know, his austere nature. And
absolutely.
But he's luxuriating in books.
That's a good point. That's an excellent point. This is what, you know, Cato's famous for. Those Stoics, right? Their dessert consists of what? Half a raisin and half an M&M.
Exactly right.
But when it comes to books, he's got no self-control.
Right.
He's just gorging.
Yeah, it's great.
Now, this word occurs one other place, which we'll just mention very briefly. I mean, a couple of other places, but one other place in Cicero, and that is in his speech, De Domo Sua, that is on his own estate or his home.
Mm-hmm.
But here, the context is really, really different. This is the Albert Clark translation of 1909, and Cicero was talking about someone who had swallowed up with him all the blood of the Republic.
Oh, man.
So helluari there means a kind of bloodlust.
Wow. So it's got all these different facets to it, right?
Or at least two.
Well, it ranges from the indulgent to, I mean, this use seems rather pernicious.
Rapine, yep.
Yes.
So Jeff, this really gets us into the meat of today's episode.
That's right.
This avidetas legendi, this gorging on books.
So for the rest of the episode, we're going to talk about some of the books we feasted on. in the past. Books that have moved us, thrilled us, have challenged us in many different ways. And we're going to be looking at both ancient and modern works.
Both ancient and modern.
Yep.
Okay.
That's right.
So, Jeff, why don't you get started then? What is one of the ancient books that has had the greatest influence on you?
Sure. When we were thinking about this, my mind immediately went to was the book I actually did my dissertation on.
Okay.
Was Apuleius's novel, Metamorphoses, or The Golden Ass, as it's sometimes called.
So this is one of the first novels, right?
One of the very first novels in the Western tradition. It's a novel that stuck with me. I never got sick of it.
Hmm.
You know, some people, you know, write their dissertation on a work, and once they're done, they never want to deal with it again.
They want to put it down and never look at it again.
But it's one of those works that every time I went back to it, kept finding more and more into it, in it. And particularly probably the part of the book that's the most well-known, the centerpiece, the Cupid and Psyche myth.
Okay.
So for our listeners who aren't familiar with this novel, there's kind of a main arc to the story. It involves Lucius, who turns into a donkey and goes through all these wanderings before he's rescued and saved by Isis. But there's these stories within stories, and the center part of the novel is this myth of Cupid and Psyche, which has always stuck with me.
So can you give us a kind of a general time frame so the listener knows what we're talking about?
Sure. For Apuleius,
you mean?
Yeah. So he was a North African philosopher, novelist, I guess you could say, from the 2nd century. So his date's somewhere from 150 to 200, we think.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the modern era.
In the modern era.
AD.
Exactly.
So he writes in prose.
Writes in prose.
Yep. And the Cupid and Psyche story.
Yes.
What are the basic outlines of that?
Well, it involves this... this jealousy that the goddess Venus has for Psyche. She's so beautiful that people are more or less worshiping her instead of Venus. And so she wants this girl gone. And so she sends her son, Cupid, to go do the dirty work. But instead, Cupid falls for Psyche.
Mm.
And they have this illicit love affair.
Mm-hmm.
And Cupid visits Psyche in the night where she can't see him. And they spend the night together, and he warns her that you can never seek out my identity.
Hmm.
Long story short, she does.
Right.
She breaks that compact, and she sees that the beautiful god of love is her lover.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, this is later reprised in C.S. Lewis' famous novel.
Right. It's one of the reasons
I
love the story. Right. I love both of those, the ancient version and then what C.S.
Right.
Lewis does with it.
So when we move on later in the episode to talk about some of the modern works,
yeah,
I'm going to have a true confession about C.S. Lewis.
Oh, I look forward to it.
Okay.
Right. So I found when I was thinking about this episode that I realized, you know, I'm drawn to stories of kind of existential longing.
Right.
Or maybe even more specific, stories that really get at the kind of the question, is there a purpose to suffering?
Yeah.
And, which I think, you know, is threaded through so much of Greek tragedy.
So I've eaten with you. I've traveled with you.
Yes.
And I've seen the way that you think about lunch, for example. Is this an instance of existential longing? I wish I could get a hamburger.
I do say that those exact words a lot.
Yes,
right, exactly.
Like the time we were in Assisi, remember?
Oh,
on a cold Sunday afternoon.
Right.
We walked and walked and walked and no sandwiches appeared.
No sandwiches appeared.
Right.
And we ended up settling for some pretty lousy sandwiches.
I don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
So Apuleius.
Apuleius, right. So Psyche then is sent on this kind of journey of suffering by the goddess Venus. And you know, she comes close to ending it all a number of times. But she ends up, I think both the Apuleian version and C.S. Lewis's version, they're both about transcending kind of physical carnal love and searching for something higher.
Right.
So for Apuleius, it turns out to be, most people think, kind of a platonic ideal of love, philosophical love. And for Lewis, of course, it was the Christian ideal of love.
But you've gorged on that book.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Now, Dave, what about you? Take us to one of your ancient works that's moved you.
Right. Well, this would be Plato's Gorgias.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I really love that dialogue. Now, Plato's dialogues, as most listeners know, are divided into early, middle, and late.
Yes. Where does this one fall?
This is right in the smack dab center of the middle dialogues.
Okay.
And at this point, Socrates is not monologuing so much as happens later, like in the Timaeus. Here you have an actual back and forth. And I read this when I was an undergraduate at Calvin. The year would have been something like 92, 93.
Yeah.
And I was in a class where we just read the Gorgias with Dr. George Harris of blessed memory.
Yes, I remember him
well. A man that you know, a man with a booming voice.
Oh, yeah.
Quite an accomplished hockey player.
Yes.
We read the Gorgias, and then later I got to read it in a course with Dr. John Hare. This was a course on Plato and Aristotle, but I never got tired of it.
Really?
I could have numerous helpings of the Gorgias and still be hungry.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's that dialogue about and what specifically did you zero in on?
Well, it's about the relationship between justice and rhetoric. And it really got me thinking as an idealistic young man, right? A person who had gorged on a lot of literature as a child, and my head was filled with lots of fantastic and idealistic ideas. It began the process of sobering me up, I would say, about what's possible in the world. And so in the course of the dialogue Plato's talking about in the, you know, in the person of Socrates, the difference between appearance and reality when it comes to words. So anyone can talk a good speech, right? And the character Polis in the dialogue, the character Gorgias himself, after whom it's named, a famous sophist, and the character Callicles, who's the most capable interlocutor of Socrates anywhere in the Platonic corpus, these three characters are big on words. But Socrates will try to show they have no substance.
Interesting.
Yeah, and he uses all of these down-to-earth kinds of examples, things like cooking and shoemaking, and they're deceptively simple and so clever. They pull you into the story.
Yeah. Would you say that Plato kind of loses his own plot in the later dialogues where he's kind of going on and on and on and on?
I would say that's true, but I can forgive him for that because it's still so interesting.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
He
yeah.
definitely departs from the dialogue format a little bit, but you know, we do that when we get old. We get a little bit crotchety.
That's true.
A little bit of a curmudgeon.
Yes.
So there's this great quote. This is from the mouth of Polis. Early on in the dialogue, polis is a Greek word that means colt. And so Socrates will tease him. You know, you're pretty frisky this morning, Polis. And Polis is trying to imitate his master, Gorgias, who is from Sicily, Leontini. And Polis has this quote. So he's talking to Chaerephon, just to get everyone's name straight. Chaerephon is Socrates' lackey, you might say.
Yes.
The ardent young man. Polis says, "O Chaerephon, there are many arts among mankind which are experimental and have their origin in experience. For experience makes the days of men to proceed according to art, and inexperience according to chance. And different persons in different ways are proficient in different arts, and the best persons in the best arts. And our friend Gorgias is one of the best, and the art in which he is proficient is the noblest." Pure and utter balderdash. It's beautiful Greek in its balance and symmetry, but it's just total nonsense.
Total nonsense.
It says nothing.
Yeah.
And as I was led through this dialogue by capable teachers, it began the process in me of thinking about the difference between appearance and reality, specifically as it, when it comes to words and speech making.
That's fabulous. I have a hard time believing that you haven't made a pun out of gorging in Gorgias.
I haven't done it yet. Let's see if I can get through the whole episode without doing that.
That's going to be a challenge for
you. Yeah. The other part, just real quickly, at the end of that dialogue, which was so impressive, is the character of Callicles. And Callicles' name means something like beautiful for his glory.
Right.
And Callicles is the strong golden lion that will later appear in Nietzsche, right? This is a look at the question of who ought to be in charge in any circumstance.
Yeah.
Callicles says, look, this is justice. The powerful, the strong, take from the weak. That's the way nature works. Ha nomos basileus, custom is king. Socrates pushes back against that and tries to find a divine justice that's not based just on strength.
Wow.
That made a big impact on
me. Yeah, that's great.
He's an impressionable young man. All right, Jeff, so what's your second work from antiquity that had the biggest impact on you as you gorged on books?
Well, I'm very eager to try to one-up your Plato here.
Okay.
And we'll get into that in a second, but before we get there, let's pause to talk about our sponsors.
This episode of Ad Nauseam is brought to you by Hackett Publishing. Since 1972, Hackett has been an independent publisher, so independent, of high-quality translations in the field of classics, as well as many other aspects of the humanities. What do you think about Hackett translations, Jeff?
Oh, I really like Hackett translations. I use them a lot in my own classes. I love Lombardo's Odyssey. I love Paul Woodruff's Bacchae. They're attractive volumes too. Great artwork, really clever and witty. Books you can judge by their covers.
I remember you saying in particular you liked the Odyssey, or was it the Iliad? The Iliad artwork, the cover
Iliad
of that.
The picture is the landing at Normandy.
Right.
Yeah.
D-Day, the 1944.
My favorite is the Bacchae with Elvis Presley on the front.
Presley.
It's perfect. Perfect. Yeah.
That captures the Bacchae, doesn't it?
Yes.
So Hackett translations are faithful to the original languages. They're accessible to the casual reader. Students and professors alike give them high praise.
That's right. But what's the best part here?
Well, the best part is that from now until December 31, it's coming up quickly, Ad Nauseam listeners can save 20% on any order and receive free shipping from
Great
Hackett
deal.
Publishing. What do they have to do to get this, Jeff?
All they have to do is go to hackettpublishing.com, find the text you want, put them in your shopping cart, and before you check out, you type in this coupon code, AN, as an ad nauseum, 2020, 2020.
Okay, so that's AN2020.
That will trigger the discount and free shipping.
Okay, so go to hackettpublishing.com, dear listener, and check it out.
That's right. Now, Dave, we also have another big announcement.
Oh, this one's huge. We are very pleased to announce today a brand new sponsor.
All right.
This is Ratio Coffee, R-A-T-I-O, Ratio Coffee of Portland, Oregon. Now, Ratio was born of a simple question. In the age of super premium espresso machines, why hasn't the automatic coffee maker evolved?
That's a huge platonic question right there.
You bet.
So, Dave, how did you first learn about the Ratio line of premium coffee makers?
Well, this is the brainchild of one of my former students, Mr. Mark Helweg.
No way.
Mark is himself a devotee of the classics and has engineered a beautiful work of art in this premium automatic pour-over machine. So it's like a pour-over where you'd put the cone on your counter and then you'd manually pour it over with great tedium. This machine does all that for you.
Yeah, I've seen them. I've looked at them online. They're
it's
beautiful.
Gorgeous. Yes. Yeah. So since 2012, Ratio has been delivering to coffee enthusiasts a solution that marries beauty, simplicity, and quality into a single experience. I have the Ratio 8 in my own home in a beautiful oyster color with real walnut accents. There's no junk, no plastic in the whole thing. It matches the rest of my kitchen. It's gorgeous. It's like a power tool on my countertop, made of all glass, high-grade aluminum. It's got a Fibonacci shower head.
That sounds made up. Fibonacci?
No, it's true, Jeff.
Isn't that a math sequence?
No. Well, maybe it's that also. It's the kind of shower head that lowers the water, which is heated to 200 degrees Fahrenheit, by the way.
Oh, my gosh.
Down into your coffee grounds. It allows them to outgas all the carbon dioxide and other noxious things. And what you end up with is a delicious cup of coffee.
Unbelievable. Well, what generous discount has Ratio decided to give our listeners today?
Well, I hope they're sitting down because Ratio is offering 15% off their Ratio 6.
Okay.
This little beauty is made from stainless steel and comes with a 5-year warranty. We don't even offer that at Ad Nauseam.
No, nothing, not even close.
No. So what kind of a coffee maker gives you that? A 5-year warranty? I've had coffee in many fine places in the world, Naples, London, Paris. I can confidently say this makes the best coffee consistently, day by day, with 3 simple stages, bloom, brew, and ready.
My goodness. So I understand this machine rated in the top 10 of all premium home coffee makers by the Wall Street Journal and places like Wired Magazine and CNET is available at Crate & Barrel in Williams-Sonoma.
That's right, Jeff. But if listeners go to ratiocoffee.com, R-A-T-I-O, coffee.com, and enter our special code, A-N-C-O.
A-N-C-O.
A-N-C-O, okay. Ad Nauseam Coffee, they will get 15% off their Ratio 6 between now and March 20, 2021.
That's amazing. I'm new to Ratio Coffee, but lately I've been enjoying some specialty grind from Ad Astra Roasters.
Yeah, that's another Latin name, isn't it?
Ad Astra, to the stars.
Yeah, so Mark hooked us up with this great roaster company in Hillsdale, Michigan.
Yes.
And they sent us these gorgeous packages of specialty roast coffee.
Yes, I've been drinking this past week, and it's amazing.
What have you been drinking?
I've really enjoyed the Femenino.
Cafe Femenino?
Yeah, and I'm out of the second bag. Remind me the name, though. It's
Las Lalas.
Las Lalas.
Yeah,
wonderful
stuff. I think
one
is from Guatemala. I've been drinking the Tenebris, another Latin name, Into the Shadows.
Into the Shadows, yeah.
Yeah, this stuff is delicious, not for the faint of heart.
No.
So go to oddostraroasters.com check out what they have.
And ratiocoffee.com.
Ratio Coffee with the special coupon code ANCO.
Check it out.
Okay, Jeff, so can you tell us about the second ancient work that really moved you?
Yes, I'm going to Sophocles' Oedipus the King.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's one of those books that, you know, I think I read it in high school.
Okay.
In translation, of course. I read it again in college somewhere along the line and never really cared for it.
Mm.
Read it in Greek in graduate school and again...
Still
didn't really care for it. It wasn't until I started teaching it.
All right.
That it really hooked me. I think that you'd agree with me that, like, teaching certainly languages, you don't feel like you really understand it until you teach it, until you have to explain it to somebody else.
That's right? Definitely true.
Right. And so I teach this consistently in my myth class, and over the years I've grown to absolutely love it.
Right.
And it's that, again, it's that It's that issue of suffering, the meaning of suffering. Is there meaning in Oedipus's suffering?
Right.
And what I've found is that in interpretations I've read or versions of the story on the screen, student reaction is that there tends to be a focus on Oedipus's kind of physical suffering. He famously gouges his eyes out, right? And he leaves kind of broken and deserted at the end of the story. And I found that that focus on kind of Oedipus's suffering, kind of poor Oedipus, in some ways misses the point. I don't think that's what Sophocles is really up to.
And
I agree. He's trying to answer the question that this most cursed man in all of Greek legend, is there a way for him to be heroic?
Right.
And so the story, of course, starts out with a plague in the city. That's the main problem to be solved.
Right.
But it quickly becomes about Oedipus.
Right.
But with his last acts in the play, where he leaves the city under his own power, blinded, broken, he's lost everything in his life, he does just that. He saves the city.
Right.
And so Sophocles seems to be saying that he finds a way to be heroic, and he finds a way, or he's saying that even broken as he is, it's better that Oedipus know who he really is than to live this lie.
Yes, self-knowledge at all costs.
Yes, exactly.
That's a really stark principle.
Right.
Do we really want to know ourselves that well?
Exactly right. It's a holding up a brutal mirror
right
up to your face. All right, so I want to read a quote here from the end of the play.
Sounds great.
And so this is at the end. Oedipus is blinded. Jocasta, his wife/mother, has committed suicide. He's lost everything, and he's on his way out of the city. And the chorus is giving him a kind of pathetic there. And they say something to him along the lines that, it would have been better if you had never been born. And it's at that moment that Oedipus, in all of his brokenness and blindness, lashes out, and he says, "Don't you dare try to teach me and say that I haven't done what is best. Enough of your advice. With what sort of eyes would I be able to look upon my father, or my pitiful mother for that matter, when I come down into Hades? No, I've done such horrible things to the both of them that simply hanging myself wouldn't cut it. Do you think I could possibly delight in the sight of my children, born as they were? Never." And this is this moment that Oedipus, in some ways, kind of takes back control.
Right.
He owns what he's done. He accepts who he is, and then he goes on to leave the city, and by doing so, saving the city.
Right.
I find that really kind of heartbreaking and powerful and moving. Yeah.
Yeah, I really love it too. Absolutely. Yeah. I love teaching it. I love trying to get students to understand some of the dynamics. I find they're often trying to look for a reason to hold him guilty that he knew what he was doing,
yes,
which is obviously a dead end.
Right.
He did not know what he was doing. He's objectively guilty in the eyes of the gods anyway, and that's a really important part of the human condition.
Right. I find students often have a problem with his temper.
Right.
The way that he kind of lashes out. Maybe the one thing we can blame him for
Laius.
Is his quick moves to violence.
Right, when he confronts his father Laius at the crossroads. But I always say, look, that was acceptable self-defense in the context.
That's true.
They're not really happy with that.
No, they don't like that.
No. Right?
So, hey, Dave, what's your second book?
Well, Jeff, my second selection is Virgil's Aeneid.
Virgil's Aeneid, yeah. If we had time, that would be on my list too.
We'll put it definitely in the queue for later on.
Definitely. So what about Virgil's Aeneid?
It had a tremendous impact on me, so much so that sometimes today, Mrs. Noe will say that I try to use adjectives in the way that Virgil does.
Is that right?
Yeah, he has such a colorful command of description.
So it's affected the way you speak.
Well, I think so, and the way I compose and so forth.
Yeah.
It's not that I do any of those things well. But I have been deeply influenced by Virgil's descriptive powers.
Ah, yeah.
So I remember first reading this poem in an undergrad class. I think Ken Bratt was my teacher for that.
Yeah.
We were using the Clyde Farr edition of the Aeneid.
Yeah, I did that too, yes.
It's got books 1 through 6. And I want to read just a little bit of book 1, which really shaped my imagination.
Yes.
So this is the speech where Jupiter is talking to Venus, and he's giving a prophecy of future Roman glory. Romulus excipiet gentet mavortia condet, moenia Roma nos quasuo de nomina dicet, his ego nec me tas rerum nec tempora pono, imperium sine fine de di quin aspera juno.
Yeah.
So there's one part there that I really love, and that's where he says, "I have given no limits on accomplishments nor on your time. I have granted, Daddy, I have granted power without end."
Yeah.
So it was just really striking the way that the Romans believed, at least as expressed by Virgil here, that their kingdom, their empire, would be eternal.
That's right.
It didn't appeal to me in the sense of thinking that earthly kingdoms ought to be eternal, but it was so confident. It was so beautifully expressed, gripped my imagination.
Yeah. And not only that, one of the things that I also really like is how that's balanced by how that really handcuffs Aeneas himself. Right?
Definitely.
He's bound by this fate, and not in a way that is, you know, glorious.
Not at all.
At all. It's heartbreaking.
It's miserable.
Right.
Everywhere he shows up, he leads in with this, sum pius Aeneas.
Yes.
I'm pious Aeneas, which means I therefore have to do these things, which I don't really like.
Right.
I have to abandon Dido and Carthage. I have to say goodbye to my father in death. I have to do all this warring in books 7 through 12.
This empire without end comes with a huge cost.
Right.
Right. And I've always been haunted by the ending of Aeneas. You know, the last act of Aeneas in the book is one of kind of bloodlust and anger.
It is. Right? Yeah. And so I was really moved by that. And then when I encountered Augustine's interaction with the story, it just opened up a completely new world to me well.
Interesting. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think we're due for you, aren't we, Jeff?
Well, I think we need to move on to the kind of the more modern world.
Oh, we got
to
go modern.
We do got to go modern, right? But
I'm not really comfortable with that. Isn't this the classically themed podcast?
Neither of us are comfortable, but we got to go there.
Well, how can you tie it together, Jeff? Make a kind of a bridge for us. Get a little bridgey. How are we going to go from antiquity to more contemporary or modern works of literature?
I think if I can speak for you here, I think that one of the things that we love about the classics is how they have influenced so much subsequent literature, right? We see their fingerprints everywhere.
A long afterlife,
right? And so our interest is not just in the classics within a kind of chronological window, but it's the how they're, you know, they're always being retold and always being repackaged and touching other works. Right. So we're not talking about modern works just for the sake of talking about them, but we're seeing them as an extension of the ancient stuff that we love.
Trying to draw out some of the connections.
That's right.
So maybe this is a good place for you to talk about Lewis and the Cupid and Psyche story.
Yeah. Well, just to tie that together, you know, Lewis himself was a professor of literature, ancient literature. He knew his classics very well. He knew his Greek and Latin. He knew his Apuleius. And so he, using the Cupid and Psyche story, not necessarily as a Platonic allegory, but using it as a Christian allegory of longing. I'm back to that kind of finding meaning in the suffering, meaning in the journey. So let me just read a quote from Till We Have Faces, which I think illustrates this this issue of longing and suffering.
This novel was published in the 50s sometime?
I believe that's right.
Okay.
I believe that's right. Lewis writes, "The sweetest thing in all my life has been the longing. To reach the mountain, to find the place where all the beauty came from, my country, the place where I ought to have been born. Do you think it all meant nothing? All the longing for home? For indeed it now feels not like going, but like going back." That restlessness, I think, that we all feel as humans.
Right.
That restlessness, that idea that things aren't the way they're supposed to be.
Yeah, living east of Eden.
Exactly right, right. And so it's a beautiful portrayal of that. That's the suffering, but also the beauty of longing.
Right.
Yeah.
You ready for my Lewis confession?
Please do. Oh,
I love that quote, by the way.
Yeah.
So here's my Lewis confession. As a child, I thought as a child, I read as a child, and I loved his Chronicles of Narnia.
Yes.
I just devoured those books. I read them, I think, each 3 to 4 times.
I'm right with you, yeah.
And it wasn't until I was in 8th grade that my teacher pointed out to me, hey, this is a Christian allegory. A what? I was shocked. The first of many times when I was not a careful reader.
Yeah.
And then as I got older, I read some of his essays, Problem of Pain, Abolition of Man, so forth. I liked it fine. It was good. Enjoyed it. And then I came to read Till We Have Faces, and I didn't like it at all.
Is that right?
Yes.
What was it about it that
can't
turned you off?
I can't say.
Yeah?
Maybe some insightful listener who shares this irrational prejudice of mine can illuminate me. But I read it when I was in my 20s. It has been recommended to me so many times. But for whatever reason, I haven't developed a taste for it.
You know, I only came to love it after, you know, I was familiar with the Apuleian precedent before I read the Lewis version.
Okay.
I think without that, I think it would have had much less meaning for me. Just the way that he kind of ties his own Christian faith together with this ancient non-Christian novel, I thought was brilliant.
That aspect to me is appealing because I like the concept of synthesizing similar ideas.
Yeah.
In a responsible way, at least.
That's right. So, Dave, you wanna talk about your modern tastes?
Yeah, there are a couple here. I'm not sure they count as modern necessarily.
Okay.
But in addition to reading all those Lewis novels as a child, right? This was before I knew there was a classics, honestly.
Yeah.
I didn't discover the classics until college. I didn't know there were things like the Iliad and the Aeneid. In addition to Lewis, I loved The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
me
too. Definitely.
I read The Hobbit, and I read all those books. I reread them before the first movies came out. I've reread them with my kids.
When did you first read them? How old were you? Do you remember?
16, 17, 15, maybe.
Yeah.
I think it was a friend of my sister's that introduced me to them,
Yeah.
What I loved about them was some of the poetry, specifically from something Bilbo says as he leaves the Shire. I love this little poem. The road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone, and I must follow if I can, pursuing it with eager feet until it joins some larger way, where many paths and errands meet, and whither then I cannot say.
It's beautiful. It's the journey again.
I love the rhythm, and I love the sense of journey, the sense of mystery. And I thought that he very capably tied together the simplicity, the humility of these little hobbits. Their worlds are so tiny, and yet one of them goes out the door to the complete unexpected.
Right, exactly.
So the idealistic, romantic aspects of my character found that just so appealing.
Yeah. And then, I think like you then, the same thing. I think I read them when I was in junior high. And then came back to them when I was in graduate school. I just kind of picked them up because I missed them.
Right.
And I was kind of blown away by the world building of Tolkien.
It's really incredible.
These things that the films just simply cannot do.
Well, not only that, but the recent film on the life of Tolkien. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I was warned away.
You're
from
wise
it.
To stay away. I watched it on an airplane when I was kind of trapped, right?
Right.
Am I going to read a book or watch a dumb movie?
Was it as bad as I was told?
Performances weren't so bad.
Okay.
The story wasn't great.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, what's your next modern work of fiction or literature that has moved you?
I am going to talk a little bit about Nikos Kazantzakis' The Last Temptation of Christ.
Really?
Yes. And I'm not doing this to try to be edgy or controversial.
Okay.
It was one of those, I think, probably most people remember it for the controversial film,
right,
with Willem Dafoe as Jesus.
Martin Scorsese,
wasn't he? 1988. It was heavily picketed and such. One of the reasons I really like this book is the circumstances under which I encountered it.
Okay.
And this was 2007. I was on Crete with a group of students, and we had a free day. And Kazantzakis was from Crete. And I wandered down to a bookstore, and in the moment, I saw it on the shelf in an English translation, and I bought it. And I walked down the street and up to this kind of raised parapet and system of walls.
My favorite kind of parapet.
In Heraklion. And there is Kazantzakis' grave.
Oh, the author.
There's benches there. And so I sat there and read a huge chunk of this book next to the grave of the author.
Hmm.
So it has this really visceral memory for me.
Definitely.
Yes. And of course, I was curious about it because, I had heard about the story, the movie, the book as being, heresy.
Mm-hmm.
Involves Jesus and
fictitious
love affair with Mary, right, Magdalene and such. And what, what really moved me about the book wasn't that stuff.
Okay.
And I think my sense of what Kazantzakis was really trying to get at was not trying to kind of poke evangelicals or anything along those lines. It was more exploring the human side of Jesus,
mm-hmm,
right? And I think what it really challenged me in kind of my own kind of Protestant upbringing was, we heard about Jesus fully God, fully human, but the absolute focus was on the divinity of Christ.
Okay.
And I thought Kazantzakis, in writing this book, was saying the human side was kind of left kind of dangling in the wind.
I think that's a legitimate criticism.
Yes.
I might push back a little bit and say, the best record of Jesus' life, the Gospels, are really thin on his everyday activities for the most part.
Sure, exactly.
You just get hints here and there. He was hungry. He was tired. He had compassion. That Greek verb, splunknidzomai, he felt something down in his vital organs.
Yes.
But it doesn't tell us a lot about, his day-to-day thoughts and feelings.
It's very true. And there's huge gaps in his biography, right?
Right.
We hear a little bit about him when he's, 12?
12, yeah.
One scene,
he's
and
in
then
the
boom,
temple.
He's, by tradition, 30.
Right.
And so I think what...
Now, the Gnostic Gospels,
right,
they fill all that stuff in.
Exactly.
Very implausibly.
Exactly right. And so, I don't think that Kazantzakis was trying to rewrite the gospel.
Okay.
But he saw that gap, and as an author, he saw an opportunity, and I found it very, very fascinating. All right, Dave, I think we got time for one more. What's your second quote-unquote modern work.
Right. Well, this is by a pretty well-known economist. Now, he's quite conservative. He's on the right. This might alienate some listeners, but, you know, we got to keep it real.
That's right.
So this is the economist Thomas Sowell.
Wow. From Kazantzakis to Thomas Sowell.
Yeah. So Thomas Sowell is out at Stanford, the Hoover Institution. And I just kind of started reading a lot of his books. I find he's one of those authors that can deal with complicated ideas in a simple fashion.
Yeah.
So one of the favorites of his that I've read is called The Quest for Cosmic Justice.
Okay.
I'm a sucker for a good title.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's great.
If the title is appealing, you know, I can cut a lot of slack to the contents.
Yeah.
Right. So Charles Dickens apparently said once he had written the title for the novel, once he had chosen the title, the rest of the work just wrote itself, basically.
Right. So in Great Expectations, he set for himself.
Great expectation. Right. So, The Quest for Cosmic Justice, and I'm going to read just a little quote. This is from 2002.
Please.
Sowell says, "One of the few subjects on which we all seem to agree is the need for justice, but our agreement is only seeming because we mean such different things by the same word." So I detect in that a kind of Socratic, look, we got to get behind the words, which are so appealing. Who doesn't want justice and fairness and peace? But these words often cover up deeper, more conflicted realities.
I see what you're doing. You're tying this back to the Gorgias.
I am, yeah. And so then Sowell says,
great.
Whatever moral principle each of us believes in, we call justice. So we are only talking in a circle when we say that we advocate justice, unless we specify just what conception of justice we have in mind.
So, David, how would you tie this back to the things you were talking about with the Gorgias and issues of justice and language there?
Well, Jeffrey, what I have learned,
yes,
and still in the process of learning, is that life has no idealistic sunny meadows, you know, no gently dappled forests where everything is peace and tranquility.
Yes.
It's a long process of my letting go of some of these romantic and idealistic notions.
Ah.
In fact, justice is about trade-offs. There's always a trade-off.
Right.
There's always a cost-benefit analysis of some kind.
Right.
Now, they call economics the dismal science. It's an avocation of mine. I like to read a lot about it. I don't really have the math to do it properly, but I like to read about it.
Yeah.
And I've come to think that cost-benefit analysis, life being full of trade-offs, is really a wise way to look at the decisions we make.
Gotcha.
And so Sowell speaks to me in that way. I hear echoes of Socrates and the Gorgias in the kinds of things that he writes. Okay, Jeff, so as we wrap up, what are your takeaways from this episode?
My takeaway is, well, I don't think we're done here.
No.
I mean, it's as you were talking about your books, I mean, I was thinking of other things that I would love to talk about.
Your mind was wandering while I was talking?
It was, exactly, right, as usually happens.
Okay.
But I'm thinking we have to revisit this topic.
Sure.
A part two somewhere down the line, mm-hmm. maybe even a part three.
Because Helluari Libris, part two.
Exactly,
gorging
right.
Gorging on books.
So my takeaway is that there's just so much more to talk about here. And
right.
And you know, one of the things I think that we're both interested in is tying the classics to things that are going on today.
Yes.
And drawing that thread throughout the ages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Dave, what stuck with you?
Well, I really enjoyed reviewing some of these things that I've read in the past, comparing physical hunger to intellectual hunger. It gives me a renewed appetite, a new aviditas legendi, to go back and read something.
Yeah. I want to pour books around me like Cato did
yeah,
now.
Yeah, absolutely. So we want to thank our listeners. We want to ask them to send us an email. Some of you are already doing that.
Yeah.
This would go to jeff@adnauseum.com. Don't forget there's a V in there. Complaints, criticisms go to jeff@adnauseum.com. Where should they send praise and gratitude?
To Jeff.
Wait a minute.
No, sorry. I guess I'll play along.
All right.
Send it to dave@adnauseum.com.
Okay. And what do we have on the menu for next week?
Oh, I'm excited about this.
Yeah, so am I.
We're talking about the death of Cicero. I'm not excited that he's dead. But,
no, you can't help that.
But it's a great story. And we're going to be talking about the death of Cicero at Formiae, date which will live in infamy.
Yeah. So Cicero died December 743 BC.
Right. So we're going to be close to the anniversary.
Right.
Yeah.
And we went down and visited Formiae.
Yes.
We're going to talk about it next week.
It's going to be great.
We want to thank, whom do we want to thank here, Jeff?
We want to thank Mishka Fernando, our intrepid engineer.
Yes.
Yes.
She puts this all together so wonderfully. And Jeff, you get the gustatory parting shot this week. I'm a little jealous.
I'm excited. This is from Christopher Morley, who said, "No man is lonely while eating spaghetti. It requires so much attention."
That's wonderful.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.